Good morning and welcome to the January 14, 2026 meeting of the Board of Island County work session. And Commissioner Johnson is excused. Commissioner St. Clair is joining us virtually. Good morning, Janet. Thank you for joining us. And so we're going to start off with the Commissioner's office. And Jennifer is giving the presentation.
Filling in for Layla, who is out today. Before you, Commissioners, we have a request for a reappointment to position 3 for the Civil Service Commission.
And that's just a reappointment?
It's just a reappointment. This individual has been on the board since 2015. The civil service is sometimes hard to get.
Civil service is hard to staff. Do you have any concerns about this position?
Janet? Nope. Thank you.
Okay. So that's good.
We do have for the IRTPO, for the TAC, which Technical Advisory Committee, the board has received a request for appointment for position 1, and that is in District 1, Commissioner Bickett.
Yes, and I'm happy to appoint her to the TAC. I'm grateful to our two individuals who have retired from the TAC, and we do need to fill their positions. Both of them did a great job. They left big shoes to fill. Do you have any concerns about this applicant, Janet?
No, I know this applicant. This will be a good fit.
Okay, great.
And then another, these are some great, we've had a lot of vacancies, so this is another great one for the Law and Justice Council. Mm-hmm. For position 1, which is also from District 1. This person, super excited to be part of the Law and Justice Council.
Council, do you have any concerns about this applicant, Janet, or questions, I should say, questions?
No, but I did notice when I was preparing for today that I have 2 vacancies, so I've already begun reaching out to see if I can find candidates for those 2 vacancies. I was not aware that my prior person had stepped down because I probably forgot.
All right. Yeah, I'm looking at the resume for this individual, and I'm saying, yes, this person belongs on our law.
Yes, but
this will be a good, this is good.
Yes. Yeah, that is a great, great fit.
Okay.
Northwest Senior Services Advisory Board. The board has received a request for appointment for position 1.
So the individual who has applied for this, Janet, who I support wholeheartedly, but my question to you is, this person is also the executive director at this point of Island Senior Resources. Is there any concern about the person who's the executive director of Island Senior Resources serving on the Northwest Senior Services Advisory Board, or do we consider that a benefit?
I think that's a benefit.
Okay.
I'm looking at the other 2. This is a pretty strong, knowledgeable group of folks, so I consider it a benefit.
Okay, great. And the next one?
The Solid Waste Advisory Committee, the board has received a request for appointment for position 9. And that is a member at large on Camino.
I did not meet with James, nor do I know much about him, but Layla would have vetted him. Are there any concerns that Layla would have brought forward?
No, I see an okay and a check mark. So
all right. Yeah.
Okay.
I like SWAC. It's a good thing. All right, go ahead.
Okay.
And then also for the Solid Waste Advisory Committee, which this one has been very hard to fill, position 12. This person's bringing some unique qualities to the Solid Waste Advisory Committee. Okay. It's hard to find that agricultural interest.
Oh, okay.
Piece.
Okay. It's that agricultural person. I think in my part, my district.
Yes.
I'm good with this individual just working on this. If you're okay with that. And I think that's all of them, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Appreciate it. Next item here today. Thank you for stepping up. Susan Geiger from Budget.
Good morning.
Good morning.
As promised, I brought forward a review of the current signing authority for procurement and also damage claim procedures.
Okay.
Those are outlined in two separate documents that I've attached. One is the Exhibit A for the purchasing authority that defines procurement levels, signing levels. And then the second is County Code, which talks about damage claims procedure. After the county administrator left, Resolution C-1425 was passed in February of 2025. That, well, actually, I'll step back a little bit. That the resolutions that allowed the signing authority for the county administrator were rescinded. The last resolution that touched this Exhibit A was to increase the signing authority for.
I think IT we increased, didn't
Yeah,
we?
IT, which they have. I talked to Dean yesterday, and he said the 20,000 is still difficult because of software. Often it's over 25,000 or over 20,000.
If he needs more, he can bring it back to us. Do you think that, I mean, he should bring it back, do you think? Explain why he would need more signing authority.
Well, he could, but he did come to me and ask, since I was bringing it forward, and asked that I talk to you about
He
it.
did, okay.
Yeah. And one of the things we talked about as well was not just software, but hardware. And we talked about the larger purchases of computer equipment. There in the capital replacement plan, when they do laptops, it's a $500,000 a year. And so that purchase order should come through on the consent for the whole year, and then they leave it open until they've purchased all the items. They don't have to purchase them all at once,
Sure.
but they do need to bring that forward to the board and have that reviewed. The signing authority for department heads is other department heads is $10,000, which has been that way for forever. And seems a little low to me, and so I would like to have a discussion and consideration regarding those levels as well.
Okay. So wasn't the reason you mentioned the I'm sorry, Jan, I'm just blathering on because I don't see you. Do you have any questions, first of all, before I start talking?
Go ahead. I am noodling.
Okay. So, as I recall, one of the drivers for this conversation was the fact that the county administrator was managing a lot of this,
Up to
up to
100,
100,000. And
yeah.
so now we have this big gap between 10, after
Mm-hmm.
$10,000.
Yeah.
So, do you have a recommendation?
I would recommend that you make department heads, with the exception of public works and facilities, at 25. Anything over 25, and it has to be budgeted, has to be within their budget. So it'd be something you should have knowledge of
Sure.
anyway.
Anything.
And then leave the public works director and facilities at 50. And then we continue to, and we eliminate this portion on the county administrator for now. I mean, I think that if when the county manager, whatever chief of staff, whatever you decide to fill this position as, they would have the same signing authority, or if you decide you could change it to something higher at that point. But we don't have a position for that right now. So, and we review this regularly, so we could add that back in. So that would be my suggestion.
So she's suggesting we up it to 25,000, Janet, your
Yeah, I
thoughts?
heard. I have a couple questions on accounting protections as we think about 25,000 across multiple departments. I'm not disagreeing with the thought process or recommendation. Can you just remind me what are our protections, the two-touch rule? How do we assure, so the director signs off on a $25,000 purchase. Who's the second signer on that?
So purchase orders are supposed to go through Laserfish, so contract review. So
Right.
it goes through through, it depends on what the procurement is, but it goes through several layers. But the basic layers are risk, and we're looking at procurement. We're looking at insurance for the procurement. Is it, if it's a purchase order, is the second page attached with all the terms and conditions? Is it budgeted? So we're looking at all those things that are risk factors for the county. Then the budget, it goes through budget as well. And that's the very end of the process. So it gets the risk portion gets looked at by Jeff in my office. And then the budget portion is the final step in the contract review. And it gets reviewed by myself. If I have questions, then I will hold it until I can get those answered. So there is multiple steps of review. If it's an IT purchase or anything affected IT, it goes through them too. If there's a legal component, it goes through the PA's office. If there's a grant component, it goes through the treasurer's office. So there's lots of opportunities to review and touch on these purchases and contracts.
So that is a very robust answer. Thank you. But who is the second signer on these larger purchases?
Well, I would consider the risk management review to be considered part of the signing off on a procurement.
Because is
Has
not
to
an audit
assign a
rule
number.
require that we have two signers on a check, or is the auditor the signer? I mean, I'm just trying to remind myself from my days when I was managing this stuff, and if I had anything over a certain amount, the GAO requires a second signature. Is that not true?
That's not true if it complies with your code, with your
Okay.
rules, with your review process. That's not true. And remember, it still goes through the auditor's office. So
Yes.
all of that gets reviewed by our local auditor's office. And then SAO, when they come in, the state auditor's office, and they do their audit work as well. They're testing procurement every single year.
Yes. Okay. That's all I'm wanting to make sure is, the essential, my short question is, are we assured that even with, because we're increasing multiple departments to 25,000, not a huge deal, but a big enough deal. I want to make sure that we have all of our protections in place to meet the auditor's requirements, both local and state. All right. I'm good. Thank you, Susan,
So
for
I have a couple questions. So
laboring it.
this is purchasing authority. Is this is specifically for department heads, correct?
Correct. I was.
Doesn't include elected officials. So what the process you just went through, what is the process that elected officials go through?
It's dependent on their discretion to a certain extent. If it is a contract that binds the county, it has to come through contract review and then to the board for signature. But if it's a purchase order, I don't see a lot of those coming through contract review. I don't see a second review on any of those coming through. It pretty much goes straight to the auditor's office.
So we hold our department heads to a much higher standard than the elected officials are held to in this type of process.
That's correct.
That's correct. Okay. I'm fine with the 25,000. My suggestion is, though, that before we put it on consent, we put it on consent after Commissioner Johnson comes back, that you have a conversation with Commissioner Johnson to make sure that she's okay with it or she's aware of it, so that if she wants to pull it off consent and address that she has that opportunity.
Absolutely.
We could put it on consent in late February so she could pull it off if she has any questions. Wouldn't that make the most sense?
Yeah, that'll be fine.
That would give me time to have a conversation.
And yeah, I do want to have a walk around conversation, you, Susan, to have a walk around conversation with everybody impacted by this.
We'll discuss it at our department head meeting, our next department head meeting.
Okay.
Thank you.
So the next part of this is the damage claim procedures.
Yeah.
On page two, the approval for the county risk manager is $10,000. There was approval in, well, actually, there is in the code an approval limit for the county administrator, which we do not have in the code. So I'm suggesting that we remove that.
Yes.
But in the interim, or even as a policy, how do we manage those claims in between $10,000 and $100,000 which go, you know, is, and actually anything over $10,000 goes through the board for
Sure.
settlement.
So,
And usually it's a, it involves an executive session. And so when you're talking about claims from 10,000 to say 50,000, an executive session for each one of those. And I'm just using that number. I'm not suggesting a change. I would like the board to decide what you're comfortable with as far as signing authority. But $10,000 is a car accident. So it's
Yeah, it's the mailboxes that get mowed over by the snowplow. It's the paint pings when a rock comes out from a road equipment. It's the small, difficult, and we don't have a ton of those, thank goodness, because our road crew does a good job.
We have some.
We have some.
So what is our deductible?
Our deductible is $100,000.
Yeah, I don't feel comfortable pushing it up to 100, but what would you feel comfortable with, Janet? 25?
No more than 2025 was what I was thinking. 10 seemed low just because when you say it's a car accident and a fender bender can be, you know, just a small car part today costs you $3,000 to replace a bumper. It's insane. So I'm fine with being a little higher, Susan, if that's something you feel like gives you flexibility, but I'm not comfortable going above that.
That sounds good. $25,000 would be consistent with the procurement signing authority too.
Right.
So I think
Okay.
that might be a good spot to land.
Okay. That
Okay.
sounds good. And then again, if you could put it on consent, but have the conversation with Commissioner Johnson.
And is the board agreeable to remove the county
100%.
portion? Yeah. Let's remove that right now. Knowing that when we rehire for that position, we'll have to relook at all of our policies again.
Okay, perfect.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. All right. And next we have public health coming up. Sean, you have a few things.
Don, are you going to start with work plan so I know where to find myself in my notes that I prepared?
Yes.
Okay.
Morning, Commissioners.
Good morning.
Sean Morris, Public Health Director. So we have two items today. The first is our work plan charters for 2026. So following adoption of our public health work plan, I've worked with our leadership team to outline project charters that outline the scope, timelines, and governance for these initiatives. The goal, of course, to stay on track and assign clear project management responsibilities, as well as milestones, and that we'll be sharing with the board along the way. And so there's a summary on the first page that walks through some key early quarter one, quarter two actions, lead project management, and our target completion for the different items. And then there's much more information in the packet around the other items I've mentioned. So for our on-site code revisions, you know, we're really looking to get, we have a number of critical activities in quarter one. You know, our RFP, we're finalizing the contract with Puget Sound Partnership. We have a kickoff meeting that we're scheduling for early February, and we are very excited to have the consultant support with this activity. This is the large update to our sanitary code and our local management plan, last updated in 2007. But it's been quite some time before we've had a comprehensive update. And so stakeholder engagement is going to be really important as we get that consultant on board. Of course, they'll be doing a lot of research. We've done a lot of internal research around other counties, the new on-site statute that we're integrating, and started some of that stakeholder outreach this past year with realtor groups and on-site professionals. And as far as a lead project manager, I'm planning to serve in a lead role with the consultant, of course, coordinating support with our subject matter experts in environmental health. And we're really working towards that quarter four adoption of the new code. So we'll have all the hearings and all the work that's involved after the code is written.
Sean, I have a question about this one.
Sure.
Okay, my first question is in stakeholder evaluation. This is really well written, but that's not surprising from you. This is just super clear and detailed, and I want to begin by saying I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And going to continue to say I appreciate it even as I grow used to this level of competency. Thank you, Sean. In the stakeholder engagement, it says zero sessions, 100% of planned sessions. How many stakeholder events do you anticipate doing?
And actually, I should correct here because we have had a two sessions in 2025, so the zero is not completely accurate. We've had one with the realtor group, but more on the WAC changes than our local. This we we'll work with the consultant and the team in the industry, but we need sessions with on-site designers, on-site installers. We need sessions with the development community and with realtor groups at a minimum. Then, of course, our internal stakeholders in planning and community development and public works. So at least 6 to 10.
Okay. And I'm going to harken back to yesterday's conversation because it's not on your work plan. And I was just struck and convicted of the presentation that was so well done. I think Quinn did it on our inspections review and the lack of follow through by our community. And again, I'm going to not assume malintention. I'm going to assume that it slips into the background of our lives. So I want to know is it within this or a separate work item that we talk about reminding people of their obligations and we have stronger follow-up? Where would that fit?
Yeah, it fits squarely within the local management plan that outlines how we use, our limited resources. Of course, it fits within code and our code escalation processes, and we're always prioritizing through that risk matrix of the imminent health hazards to prioritize our limited enforcement resources, but also that targeted outreach for inspection compliance of thinking about critical areas, shoreline areas where we really are focusing. Of course, that work is ongoing with PIC, with our adaptive management work. So we already take that focused approach, but we can strengthen it as part of this update.
Well, I guess I want to see an explicit thing saying we're going to strengthen how we monitor and enforce that particular thing because we've identified a failure in our own internal systems. So if we can add that somewhere into your work plan, just as a reminder for the board and a reminder for you all to check in on that. And the other thing that occurred to me after our meeting when I was noodling on this was that one of those had gone through the franchise agreements, had gone through purchase and sales, but yet had somehow not done it is required at purchase and sale because I've sold a property and bought properties in Island County. And so how could we have had the required higher level septic inspection at purchase and sale either not be recorded, which I actually personally have experienced having done one and not having it recorded. So I know that that sometimes also happens. How did it get through a purchase and sale process? So again, emphasizing your outreach with our real estate community, how could a property have exchanged hands without having met that requirement was something that occurred to me. Or maybe it did and just did not get recorded. Recorded because, again, that is also a possibility.
Yeah, those are all great points. And we can think comprehensively about the levers that we have or so that we can get those inspections completed. And I'll note that and discuss with the team as part of this process.
Okay, that's it for this section. Sorry for my deep question or my questions.
I
Not to
don't.
apologize, I don't have any apologies for it. Just thank you.
Yeah, and then item two is the wastewater proviso, which is really linked to item one. Maybe it could be considered a sub part of this when we've talked a lot about the community on-site, and we're decoupling that from state large on-site standards to build community standards similar to Kitsap County. And again, the consultant will be supporting us with this. The item that's in flux that we're monitoring the legislative session is the board priority around the quality assurance plan for demonstration projects. And we'll see if that funding comes through, if we're looking at other avenues. We still will need those approvals from the Department of Health on-site septic team in order to pilot public domain community on-site technologies. The quality assurance plan is that engineering plan that gives us the, that could make them feel more comfortable with this approach and lay the groundwork for it. So there are some, the legislative session and the budget will help us know our next steps around the demonstration sites. And then item three, the water system plan. So we have the full recommendation report from our consultant, Facet. It's quite comprehensive. Our hydrogeologist, Dr. Chris Kelly, has led that effort and will continue in this year. He'll be bringing the recommendations to the Board of Commissioners soon, I think an upcoming work session. And there will be a request with that to formally convene the Water Resources Utility Convening Committee. I forget. The WUC, and that consists of the planning director, public health director, a representative of a large water purveyor. So we'll walk through next steps for that in an upcoming work session.
So I had a person who is the president of a diking district and a large water indicate to me that he would like to serve on this. So what will be the process to ensure that we do have community involvement?
We've worked on developing a nomination process where the water systems, the group A is the requirement. We could look at group B as well, where there could be a voting process for representation that we could then bring to the board as that representative. So we'll dive into that at the work session, but we'll need some type of nomination and approval process for those community stakeholder members.
Okay, thanks. Janet?
My question was the difference between the WUC and the RAC, because we had the RAC, the Water Resource Advisory Committee, which brought forth some recommendations for the CWSP in 2020, which we deferred because 2020 was 2020. And I think those got rolled into some of our comp planning, but we never actually addressed them separately as a board. What's going to be the difference between the WUC and the REC? And I think you started on that answer with Commissioner Bacon. And how are we setting this up? Because the REC, we decommissioned the REC.
That's right. And so these are statutorily required committees in order to update a coordinated water system plan. So, as you shared, we start with the Water Resources Advisory Council. They convened and came up with the recommendations in the direction around the CWSP. We took those recommendations, we developed this comprehensive approach, the comprehensive report, and then statutorily, the board would need to convene now the WUC. Is the next step in getting this vetting the recommendations and developing that.
That's helpful. Thank you, Sean. I was trying to put the things together, and that helps me. Thank you.
You also need to think a little bit about how time impacts all of this, because wasn't the RAC de hasn't the RAC not met in the last 20 years? I mean, this is
No, it was decommissioned in 2021.
right, but they hadn't met in a long time before that, I don't think.
The
Yes,
long time lag.
19 is when they just issued their comments.
Oh, okay, they did 2019. Okay,
But I think
thank
I
you. Thank
know
you.
what you're thinking of. It's the CWSP. There hasn't been a comprehensive update since 1990.
Oh, okay, so that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Okay,
Yeah,
thank
the
you.
RAC brought forth some somewhat contentious recommendations. They weren't unanimous in 2019. Maybe they brought it to us in the beginning, January of 2020. I don't remember. I just remember that it was on our agenda to talk about in 2020, and then we took it off the work plan because of the pandemic.
Okay.
And then we never came back to it for whatever, it's just that was 3 years of my life I'll never get back.
Okay.
Before times. Okay, next item, of course, is the CHIP. We have the draft report. We're working through that. We've been connecting with colleagues in human services and planning and working on the alignment of the CHIP report following community feedback and, of course, our CHA. Community health assessment. So we'll be bringing the draft report to the board in quarter one, 2026. And then two of the projects that we're highlighting here for the work plan are the Thrive Resource Directory that we're looking for a launch. It's a short timeline because this funding is coming from the CDC and we have to use it by the end of June of this year. So our RFP is already out. We're recruiting for the technology consultant, and that'll involve partner engagement. And we're looking to launch really quarter two of 2026. And we're excited about that project. The other item is our vaccine procedures. And we'll be bringing a discussion to the Board of Health. We're looking at a Q3, maybe Q4 development of the childhood vaccine program protocols, safety procedures, and applications. Looking to use our mobile vaccine or mobile clinic for back to school vaccines starting in 2027. And then, as far as project management, our community health manager is leading the vaccine effort. Actually, Taylor and I, our deputy and I, are leading the Thrive, and Taylor is lead for our community health improvement plan. And then, last but not least, is the next phase of our SmartGov project. So we are working with Amanda, the SmartGov permit coordinator, and our environmental health team to launch the online portal for on-site septic permits. We have a goal of quarter one to have permitting online for on-site septic, and the lead for those projects are, of course, Amanda and Heather, our environmental health manager. And we're also working on the Bluebeam integrations to support all the digital review. And so that would be March, April, that we have a go live date for our septic permits.
Okay. How about your other permits, like burn permits? Are those live? Are they the same schedule? The other permits for public health.
It actually, as part of this, we would then transition into WAV burn permits, and so those would be the two main categories. So this year as well.
Thank you. I think this looks great. And Janet already expressed her. Yes, Janet.
I'm really we're very excited and supportive to see this be fully online. Sean, in objective three under the digital, you talked about education using FPHS. I'm probably not going to surprise you that our FPHS funding and all the gains we made in that area is seriously threatened at this point in time. So anything that we're doing here that is dependent upon FPHS funding, we may need to revisit partway through the year and see where we're at.
Yes, my thoughts as well. As we know, FPHS is under strain, and so we'll see. Ideally, we'd love to, create these educational videos to walk the public through the processes, knowing that takes the resources to develop that and a consultant. So we'll check in with the board on FPHS as we get through the legislative session.
100%. I think that's going to be a challenge.
Okay, so again, there's much more information in the packet on these charters, and then our next step as leadership is walking through these with all of the, the responsible folks for the project management and planning this out.
Well, I'm just delighted we're moving forward with the septic solutions problem that we identified years ago, and we got money from the state to just continue along that path. So, thank you, Sean.
And then our next item, right, Natural Resources Manager Jen Schmitz to discuss contract with Washington State Department of Ecology for Marine Resources Committee. This is $75,000, I believe, one-time funding for project administration and grants management related to derelict vessels and derelict crab pot removal contracts management. But pass it over to Jen.
Good morning, Commissioners. Jen Schmitz, Natural Resources Manager. Yes, Sean gave a great overview of the contract, and you all are probably familiar with these OTGP, one-time grant projects. And they say one time, but we get them every year. These are reliable sources of funding through our partnership with the Department of Ecology. Each year, the Marine Resources Committee identifies the projects that they'd like to work on with this type of funding. And this year, they've identified derelict vessel and derelict crab pot equipment removal from Skagit Bay, so around our area and around Island County. So the one-time grant is for January 1. So we've already embarked within this time frame. So whenever this contract is executed, we'll get right on the work. The Marine Resources Committee identifies project leads for each of these projects, and the derelict vessel and derelict crab pot leads have already been identified and are ready to start work. So this $75,000contract will support that project through next year.
Okay.
Any questions? Yeah, Jana.
You said derelict vessel, derelict crab pot in Skagit Bay, Saratoga Passage, Port Susan, the west side of Whidbey, all see significant derelict vessels because of prevailing winds. Why are the is the derelict vessel program limited to Skagit Bay, or is it the crab pots that's limited to Skagit Bay, or was that just an example?
Just an example, and in fact, I believe our derelict crab pot lead is from Kameno, if I'm not mistaken. So, no, it will be throughout the. I believe it's attached to the contract, the actual scope of work, a little bit more information, but
Well, it
the.
says Skagit Bay in our contract. That's why I'm asking.
Oh, that's a great question. I can follow up if that's an error on Ecology's side, we can get that remedied. But the derelict crab pot and derelict the I'm sorry, the derelict crab pot lead, I believe, is from Kameno. The derelict vessel lead is Kelly Webb. And I do not believe there's any geographic constraints on either of those. It would
So
be
look on, yeah, when
fine.
you get a chance, check page 2 of 36.
Sure.
And the crab pots, if there's a reason, and there may be because it's a high value salmon area that they're focusing on Skagit Bay, and because of the Skagit cooperative, I can understand the crab pots being a high priority area based on the other
Sure.
action items. What I don't understand, because of the way the prevailing winds move, and where our derelict vessels occur, and you can map see those on the map on DNR, they're less likely to be in Skagit Bay.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. Yes, the derelict vessel is not related to Skagit Bay. That is countywide because we get those as reported. People report them as they see them, as our volunteers see them, and we respond to that. So
Then
the
I think.
language is feels like it's lumping it together, but it's not.
Yeah,
It's
but
just.
it's not. A is specific to derelict vessel and B is specific to crab pot. So that's probably on me
Correct.
for not reading it as carefully as I should. But
No, it's all one big sentence.
I want to make sure because, and my second question then, sorry, why do I keep apologizing for asking questions? Girl born in the 50s. The second question I have is this funding from the Derelict Vessel Act that passed 2 years ago, or about that increased funding to all counties to address that. Do you know?
I do not believe so. No, this is our normal pot of funding that we access every year through Department of Ecology. It's possible
That's
that they, on their back end, have tapped into that, but that's not something exclusively written out for this.
well, that's good news because we tap into that funding when we make reports to state DNR to remove and mitigate against derelict vessels. So that's actually really good news. So appreciate that. Thank you, Jen.
So I'm going to say something that I probably shouldn't say. It's not going to re reflect in my approval of this project in any way. But as I look at the scope of work, and we're looking at half the dollars are going to pay for grant and project management, and the other half is going to the actual dealing with abandoned and derelict vessels. Only 9,000 going to abandoned, 95, 9,600 to abandoned and derelict vessels, and 30,000 to the derelict crab pot prevention and removal. I think that that's I find that as a taxpayer, it's troubling to me, but I support the project. We have to pay our people. I'm just not seeing why the management of this would cost as much as the actual removal of the derelict vessels and the crab pots.
That's a good question to follow up on. They do not give very descriptive deliverables in here either to outline what all that work would go into. So I'm happy to follow up on that.
Okay,
It's a good
thank you.
point.
I don't move very many derelict vessels for $9,600, by the way.
It's a great question, but if the operational dollars enable us to tap into the derelict vessel funding from 2 years ago that doubled, that may be the answer. but it's a really good question, and I'm just guessing.
It is, and there's not, again, not very descriptive scope of work line items in the contract. So,
I may have this incorrect. When I read this scope of work, I was wondering if some of the educational outreach materials for derelict
Oh, of
vessels
course.
fell within the but that first bucket, which
Okay.
is then
So
extending the
material.
reach materials, but also the that outreach work itself.
In fact, derelict vessel education is a huge component. When we were at the MRC conference, Commissioner Bacon, last fall, we heard a lot from our ecology friends about how they're working on, pump out, dump out programs and et cetera around the county, and how it does take a pretty extensive amount of material that you give away at booths and things.
Oh, that's
But
right. I remembered that. That was really
it was a
interesting.
great presentation,
Yeah,
but it
well.
would be nice if it were outlined a little more clearly
Oh,
in the
okay.
contract for sure.
I feel better now. Thank you. Okay, certainly this will go to consent. We're Commissioner St. Clair and I both huge fans of the MRC. It's not a problem. We support this.
Thank you,
Thank
Commissioner.
you very much.
And if the two of you have a chance to stick around for the planning
Yes.
conversation, thank you.
I will be
Yes.
here. Thank you.
All right, planning. We're trying to get to you sooner again. Do we need a break, Janet?
No, I'm fine. Thank you. I got to pull up my notes, though.
And Emily Neff is online, so we're gonna make her panelist and then she'll share the presentation.
All good. Okay. Will we be pregnant? Okay, good. About 10:30. Well, we are going to talk about climate first, and that's what their homework is. That's okay. They can listen to it. Okay, can everybody hear me?
Emily, we can't hear you.
We don't hear you yet, Emily.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we hear you now.
Great. Okay, are you seeing the right screen or do I need to switch my monitors here?
Looks good.
Okay, good deal. All right, Emily Carr and I are going to tag team this presentation here today, but we're back with more comp plan materials to review from our draft release. And today we're talking about the elements that are related to the environment. And so let's get into it here. And all right, so today's work session is focused on our natural resources element and our climate elements. And again, these reminders are the same reminders that we had during our last session, but just wanted to briefly mention that we're focused on goals and policies, which are our guiding principles in these sessions to frame our future code updates. And this is particularly important this session because the code updates we reviewed last session were part of housing, but all the code updates related to natural resources and our climate elements, all those code updates will happen through implementation over the next several years as we work on implementation for the comp plan. So just wanted to mention that, today's session and as we review these drafts, we're still focused on the what, but not the how, not implementation solutions. So we want to make sure that the goals and policies in these elements are broad but specific enough to kind of cover what we want to see on the ground during implementation phases. And then just a few reminders to keep in mind competing priorities. So the natural resources element is an optional element under the Growth Management Act, which is sort of confusing because it contains all the goals and policies that are the basis for our critical areas ordinance. But it is one of many priorities that the county has, right? We know that the board has set three priorities of health, equity, and climate resilience, and so we're keeping all of those priorities in mind as we review these elements.
So to be clear, natural resources is voluntary and climate is mandatory.
That's right. Yeah. So climate is the new requirement under the Climate Commitment Act, and the county is required to do a climate resilience element. We were not subject to the greenhouse gas requirements that were part of the Climate Commitment Act, but the climate resiliency element is required.
Thank you.
Thank you for that clarification. I think I said it backwards the other day.
So just wanted to men briefly mention here that the climate element is one thing we're going to be looking at today. It kind of sets the framework for how we're going to plan for climate resiliency. It does include the climate hazard and vulnerability analysis and all the new goals and policies related to climate resiliency. The natural resources element, which is an existing element we've always had and was updated, but it has all the background on our critical areas, groundwater, and natural resource lands. It also highlights our conservation efforts and our tax benefit programs, and again, has all the kind of goals and policies that oversee all of those. And then finally, the critical areas ordinance is very closely related to these topics, but it won't be updated until after the comp plan. The state gives us a 12-month grace period after we adopt the comp plan to update critical areas ordinances. So just wanted to mention that critical areas will be updated, but not until after the comp plan. Okay, so our approach in looking at the environmental updates was to balance kind of the environmental protections that folks were asking for with our housing and economic growth demands and requirements from the state. We got a very clear housing mandate from the state. And so we're trying to make sure that we're being thoughtful and balancing our need for growth with our need to protect environmental constraints across our islands. And then second, to address and enhance community and ecosystem resiliency. Again, this is related to the climate mandate. And then finally, just to continue the efforts to conserve, protect, and enhance critical areas, groundwaters, farms, and forests, which are all the kind of basis in the natural resources element.
Emily, can I just make one comment?
Sure.
We talk about balancing environmental protections with housing as a binary, and in some ways it is, and in some ways it isn't. We can do both. Definitely economic growth is not a binary because our economy, our local tourism economy, as an example, is very much tied to our natural resources and what we have to offer. And so I think it's often for me easy to think of things as polars or binary conversations when really there's sort of a circular conversation happening between our natural resources, those environmental protections, and how it supports economic growth. And so I think of it sometimes, I've been trying to train myself to think of it more as a circular paradigm than a binary one.
Yeah, that's a great point. And maybe balance isn't quite the right word there. But
It's okay. I'm
certainly
not trying to
we've been,
wordsmith.
oh no, it's okay. It's just we've been thinking as we update the elements, you know, they're all very much tied together and integrated. And so
Yeah.
as we talk about one topic, we want to really just recognize that one topic is inherently tied to another. And absolutely, they're all, you know, economic growth and housing and environmental protections all kind of go together. So we don't want to forget the other topics as we're focusing here.
And
But I
frankly,
appreciate
your
that.
narrative within the elements did that. Because I read for that carefully, and you did emphasize that within how you wrote this up. So I'm not trying to be at all corrective here, just emphasizing that for me, I've had to retrain my Western mind to think of it in a circular paradigm.
I appreciate that. So required updates, just wanted to continue to emphasize that the climate element is brand new and required by the Climate Commitment Act and House Bill 1181. And the purpose is to address natural hazards created by or aggravated by climate change, to identify, protect, and enhance natural areas, to foster climate resiliency, to identify, protect, and enhance communities' resilience to climate impacts, and to incorporate best available science and no net loss into critical areas policies. That last one is a natural resource requirement. Mainly, I just wanted to emphasize here that, you know, this is the county's first step into climate planning. And the Climate Commitment Act and House Bill 1181 requirements are really all about climate resilience planning. So folks, when they're reading this element and reading the goals and policies, shouldn't think of this as a mitigation plan. It's really a resiliency plan. It's looking at our vulnerabilities and our risk levels and coming up with measures to make our communities more resilient. So just keep that in mind as we review. So I'm going to hand it over to Emily Carr to go through some of the climate data that was in the
Let me go
element that we
back a
wanted to
slide just
review.
because I had some overarching thoughts there.
Sure.
The address natural hazards bullet point, there are two bullet points I want to address, created or aggravated by climate change. One of the questions I have, and I haven't yet informed myself, it came up a little bit yesterday in some public input, but I had sent you notes saying, where and when do we address the fact that states and some counties are beginning to plan to implement planned retreat frameworks, framework policies, not definitional, like not like this is when, not operationalizing it, but at least identifying. And we did not have planned retreat as of yet into this element. And I was going to look up 1181, and see if they identify planned retreat. I know San Juan County, for example, is looking at some of their roads and when will they abandon those roads and plan for alternatives. So I don't know when and where that fits, but I wanted to just highlight that was one of my questions I sent. And a question that we will get is incorporate best available science and no net loss into critical areas. Because it's been an ongoing debate at our state, there is conversation that will come back to us about why are we not implementing net gain? And the answer is not that we don't value net gain, but that at this point we're trying to meet state requirements, and the state statute is no net loss. There is debate at the state level of whether or not they will eventually implement net gain, but it does not exist now. And the county as a whole tends to pretty consistently not exceed state requirements. That doesn't mean that we don't value net gain and that we're not thinking about it and pursuing it. But in terms of how we will define this in our element, we're going to wholeheartedly meet the standards that the state lays out, and that is no net loss. Is that fair and accurate in your opinion?
Yes, I think that's a good summary of where we're at on that.
Thank you.
I would also apply kind of that same thinking, honestly, to the your first point about managed retreat. I know the state is hosting a lot of conversations right now around the Shoreline Management Act and around changing some of that to start mandating some retreat planning or resiliency planning, and the state hasn't come out with guidelines for that yet. So you might be right that some counties are opting to do some policies now proactively for that, but we haven't stepped out ahead of what the state's guidance is. The state really doesn't have clear guidance for managed retreat at this stage, but I'll have Emily Carr weigh in if there's anything else in
Yeah, and I
the
haven't done my
climate
research on it
requirements.
yet.
Yeah.
I haven't done research on this in a couple of years since we got that coastal flooding report. And so I hadn't had time to do that. That's helpful, Emily. Thanks.
Yeah. If I could just add to that too, the next shoreline management program is due in 2028, and we will start looking at that once the critical areas ordinance has been updated. So if we highlight anything today when we get to sea level rise that we do not think we don't want to step in front of our SMP as it is still would be called you right now with this climate element, but we will flag things for our SMP update
Okay.
that will be happening within the next few years.
Okay, good.
And there's a difference in public and private assets too when we think about planned retreat or the different language we use around that. I say planned retreat, but whatever, managed retreat. And I think you're right that we have to put this in order. I don't know if we should have a reference phrase because it's coming just or not, and I haven't finished doing my thinking on this, so I don't have a recommendation, but it was just, we know it's coming.
I hear you. We can talk as staff and then maybe talk in one-on-ones to see what we explore further.
I want to make a statement in support of science that in a different universe I would not have to make, but I do need to make it here. And that is, if you read this draft, you'll see very clearly that Island County believes climate change is real. And Island County expects our leadership to adhere to the directive to increase climate literacy that's defined in goal one of this plan that we're going to be talking about here today. So, climate change is a real thing. So that's my statement.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One
Okay.
more thing before we move on to the map slides. Commissioner St. Clair just pointed out that this is about government-owned assets, and I think that's a good point as we talk about the climate resiliency element, because the vulnerability and risk assessment were really about, they're not about private property, it's about government assets primarily and our government's ability to plan for climate resiliency. So just wanted to mention that as a framework as well.
That's what I read.
Okay, before I dive into the first climate hazard, I just want to give a general overview for the public and reminders to the board. We hired a consultant to help with our climate element, and they analyzed the county to determine what climate hazards will greatly affect over the next 20 years. And those climate hazards were heat, sea level rise, and changing precipitation. The maps on the next three slides have segmented areas that represent the census block, and each census block was individually analyzed for their vulnerability for those three climate hazards. Not every parcel within that block will be impacted by the climate hazards in the same way. For example, if you're on the shoreline, some of those properties will be impacted greater than parcels that are more inland in that same census block. So you might see these dark colors that represent high impacts and high risk. But not every single property or person within that census block will be impacted in the same manner. So diving
They did
into,
this,
oh,
Emily, they did this by census block.
correct. That was
That's interesting. That's really highly disaggregated because I'd seen it in the past done by zip code. My brother was involved in research that looked at predictive climate or temperature changes out of Oregon State, but I've never seen it this disaggregated to census block as you had in there. And that is, it's common sense, right? When you look at where they put like the north end of Port Susan Bay, but just really says a lot about the capacity of science to define things.
I, yeah, zip code is very broad too, especially on our islands. And the census block, when it comes down to this vulnerability index, allowed us to analyze based off of race, color, household income, everything under the sun that the census analyzes. And then they use data from the state and also from the federal government, from HUD. So there was a lot of data brought into this map. I was going to say this later on in the presentation, but if anybody wants to dive further into these maps and click around, it has all the data. You can read it all on our website, Island County 2045.
Well, in the Oak Harbor data and the little slice of data above Crescent Harbor was interesting to me because we have to meet the environmental justice requirements that our state put in place, and that there's that data right there. So to click into that section and see what are the threats, I have an idea, but I would love to look at that because that's also, what's the word? It correlates to our social vulnerability indices that say that's also the area where we have the folks with, as your second bullet point points out, the highest risks. So, sorry, I just think this, as a data wonk, I think this is fun.
Yeah, this stuff really fascinates me. And you are correct. Our denser areas usually also have the affordable housing, and it draws people of lower income in, mobility issues because more better access to transit. And if those areas are hotter due to increased heat and being concrete deserts, it causes issues. So we have to take that into consideration with future planning.
So that will, I'm just going to say it because it fits here, even though it's elsewhere. In our elements, we talked about increasing our forest canopy as a goal. And I would say it's really important that we say increasing our urban forest canopy because of exactly the data you're showing me here, that we emphasize our urban forest canopies over general forest canopies when we look at rebuilding forest canopies because of the heat dome that happens over urban areas and because of the risk that happens for health and safety out in those communities. So if you'll just note that I'd like to have that somewhere in that we emphasize the forest canopy work first in our urban areas.
Okay, I will note that. Just do a quick overview of the heat hazard. Extreme increases in extreme heat will lead to drought acceleration, increased wildfire risk, and more extreme precipitation events as the warmer air holds more moisture, leading to rainfall events such as flooding and landslides. And like we just chatted about, people of color, lower income households, and people with mobility issues have increased risks. And our heat vulnerability index specifically highlighted that areas in Northeast Camino and Southeast will have increased risk from heat and poor air quality.
I
Okay.
want to check where our purple air monitors are with Northwest Clean Air Agency because I think we have one on South Whidbey, but I don't know that we have one on Northeast Camino, and this data tells me I should advocate for that.
Good idea. Okay. The next climate hazard is sea level rise. The map on this slide uses the worst case projection of a 3 foot sea level rise by 2100. So, a few decades after our planning period of 2045. But just to highlight that any building within 10 feet of this 3 foot rise scenario is considered to be at risk. However, again, not every single parcel within those census blocks will be affected or affected at the same level of risk. Increased sea level compounds existing as hazards, such as more frequent and severe coastal flooding and storms, increased rates of beach loss and bluff failures, rising water tables and saltwater intrusion, and ecosystem and habitat loss, just to name a few of them. There's quite a bit more risks listed out in the element itself. Low-lying areas on Camino and South Whidbey are again at risk for sea level rise, and sea level rise combined with heat and drought increases the risk for these communities. We have quite a few policies in our new element about sea level rise, but again, we're trying to guide the next SNP so that they continuously complement each other.
Right.
Okay.
And it's not just property damage, it's also saltwater intrusion where these high risk areas are. I don't know if we need to say that. It's intuitively obvious, but it is not just property damage, it's also water risk.
Correct. And with the rising water table, it impacts septics and roads, as we talked about a minute ago. It's not just about the houses. You are correct. And I think another thing, actually, we had a climate advisory team, which was about 10 or 12 community members that helped us with
Excellent.
this entire new climate element. And they truly highlighted that we shouldn't just be looking at our built habitat, but also the loss of our natural habitat, because we need to help out the ecosystem in saving itself in this situation with sea level rise. And the final climate hazard that we looked at was changing precipitation patterns. Once again, darker colors on the map represent increased precipitation. And while our annual precipitation is projected to increase, this rise will occur during our rainy season. Our already dry summers are projected to become even drier, meaning that our entire county will feel it at some point of the year, whether that is in our areas such as North Whidbey and North Camino, where the higher rates of rainfall will be experienced. They will experience increased flooding, small landslides, etc. And areas with lower rates of rainfall may experience increased drought and longer drought seasons throughout our summer. And then Our changing precipitation patterns will affect our entire county due to the reliance on groundwater to refill our aquifers.
I have no idea where this fits, but people will make the assumption that because of higher rainfall, that the darker areas are going to not be as impacted in terms of agricultural productivity. And so, oh, you know, South Whidbey will be negatively impacted, but that's actually not true because when we have higher intense rainfall, it's actually not recaptured if we don't have good soil health. And the ability to recapture rainfall is directly related to the soil health and the sort of regenerative practices that are happening. And I'll give Beachview Farm a shout out here for having done some amazing work in this area. But the risk is the same in North and South Whidbey, even though one gets more precipitation because we don't have. If we don't have good soil health, that recapture does not occur. So that again goes to that economic value of what happens with climate.
Good points. We can try to fit that in somewhere. We'll see where it fits best.
I think smarter people than me can talk about it in a more articulate way about the value of regenerative ag or transformational ag or whatever. There's different language that we have to define that's in there. And I know that Senator Mazzal helped sponsor a soil health bill, and maybe there's good language within that as well. So I just think being able to reference some of what the state has already referenced and those agricultural practices that mean we can capture that water and not just lose it back into the sound is important for us to pay attention to.
Okay, sounds good. And before we dive into the policies, are there any other
Sorry, I'm
questions?
this one really, you guys knew I was going to talk a lot about this one, right?
Yeah, no worries. It's a fascinating topic. I don't mind chatting about it.
We can go on.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, so diving into the policy changes, again, just wanted to highlight that we pulled out kind of the new policies and the major changes in the notes that are on the slide here, so folks could kind of follow along on where the biggest changes happened in these elements, because we know it's a lot of information to dive into, but certainly there's lots more updates that were made to these elements than just the ones on the slide. So just wanted to mention that. So starting at the top here, conservation policies. Our conservation policies cover kind of a broad range of topics. We have policies that address resource conservation, land conservation, and then kind of conservation of lands for wildlife corridors. And so all of those in the natural resources element have been kind of strengthened as part of this update. And then the climate element contains some separate policies for coastal ecosystem conservation that are consistent with our kind of sea level rise resilience planning. So, any questions on those policies that, during your review?
I had one question, and Melanie, please don't let me take over too much.
You're doing fine, Janice.
Okay. So my question's on the second bullet point here, and it was the interconnectedness of the nearshore environment. And I did not see our nearshore environment called out. I saw our shoreline environment called out, but a lot of our work is also in this context of conservation and protection is also to protect the nearshore environment. So I'm going to go back, take you all back several years to when we protected the Pearson stretch of land, the Pearson acquisition with the land trust, where we had 1.5 miles of eelgrass right in the nearshore. So clearly, by protecting the feeder bluffs, by protecting against pollutants, all of that conservation action we took several years ago, and I use it only because it's not any more special than any of the others. It's just clear in my mind the interconnectedness. And so I don't know if there's any place in this element where we can call out the interconnectedness to our shoreline policies with the nearshore environment. I didn't
We
see
can.
it. Maybe it is there, Emily's, but I didn't see it.
Emily Carr, has anything jumped to your mind in the climate element? We can take another peek at that to make sure it's covered.
Not off the top of my head, but I just made a note. Oh, actually, we have one about nearshore habitat restoration projects in goal 2. Other than that, we can strengthen policy language.
Eelgrass and bull kelp are critical in our on our Whidbey Island marine environment.
So since Jan's raised the issue, and I didn't know where to put this either, I want to mention something that I talked about at the Leadership Whidbey conference or meeting that the other day, and I was one of the speakers at that. And I was talking, we were talking about the proliferation of armoring along the shoreline. And I said that every week I talk with people, every single week, not an exaggeration, who want to protect their land. I also mentioned that one of the things that I hear from citizens along the shore regularly is an acknowledgement that someday their property will be underwater. They acknowledge that, for the most part, people who talk to me. And what they are trying to protect is their property over the next, what, 10, 15, 20 years that they will be living in that home, maybe a few years for their child to live in or whatever, but they are not trying to keep that safe in perpetuity because they know that's not possible. So, and maybe this is a thing that we address when we do the SMP, probably, but I'd like, you said you're going to keep track of notes, Emily. So I think I would really like us to have the conversation with the citizens about the possibility of us saying, okay, you can do armoring for your home. And by 2045, all armoring or whatever, this is just numbers I'm throwing out. And this isn't based on science. I'm not a scientist. You can do armoring to protect your home for you and your family right now, living here right now. In 2045, say, all of that armoring along the shoreline is either going to come down, or certainly the county's not going to permit any additional changes or improvements. And if you go and do an unpermitted one, we're going to go take it down. I mean, we have to at some point start taking action in response to the reality that is in front of us. And we have to start making policies that people can plan for over the long term that acknowledge what is going to happen. And so I would really hope that I don't see it in here, and it doesn't, maybe isn't, I'm not going to make you go add this, but I think when we do the SMP, the next SMP, there needs to be some kind of acknowledgement that things have to shift and people will have to plan for this shift. So thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else on conservation before we move to critical areas? Okay. So there are a lot of policies, as I mentioned, related to critical areas in the natural resources element. These policies really are kind of the policies that oversee our critical areas ordinance. So goals 2, 3, 4, and 5 and all the sub policies really cover our critical areas. They address all of the critical areas that are defined under the Growth Management Act. So wetlands, aquifer recharge areas, fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas, frequently flooded areas, and our geological hazardous areas. And then we have some climate policies under Goal 6 that also address critical areas. Any questions about any of those during your review that jumped out?
Climate Goal 6, I see that as a public health goal. It's talking about ensuring the protection and restoration of streams, riparian zones, estuaries, wetlands to achieve healthy watersheds that are resistant to climate change. Was this developed in conjunction with our public health department?
Yes.
They're aware of all of these? Okay.
Yeah, so I should have said that when we did our goals and policies review in the spring, all the departments gave input on the kind of initial draft changes to the goals and policies, and we took that feedback and incorporated it into the final versions.
Okay.
Emily, I think you made a couple of important points in this section. that hopefully are clarifying for folks. You, one of them I thought that was very good was you said there is a difference between the identification of critical areas or wetlands and the regulation of those. And those happen as two separate actions in a governmental way. That's how I read that. And I think that's super important only because we first have the mapping of critical areas is an iterative process and is constantly changing and constantly at a controversy for folks, right? And as these climate things happen, we will continue to see the mapping and designation of critical areas change over time. And the reason I raise that is because in my, what, 6, 7 years here, people say, but I've always done it this way. There was never a critical area. That was never a wetland. But these things change over time as the climate impacts it. So for the public to understand that when the designation of a critical area and the regulation of it are two separate things, and that it will be iterative, it will change over time. So I just appreciated that clarity. And let's see. It was that whole section on wetlands that I found really well done. I think that's it for now, Emily.
Thank you for mentioning that, Janet. I get that a lot. People say people are angry because suddenly their backyard's been declared a wetland. It was never a wetland. Yeah, and now it is. These things change. So thank you for acknowledging for that statement.
I thought it was well articulated by the guys here, by the team, the guys.
Okay, anything else there? All right, the next section is groundwater. So natural resources covers groundwater under goal 6 in protecting the groundwater as a resource and ensuring recharge and it's protected from contamination. And then goal 7 is focused on how the groundwater is used once it comes out of the ground as drinking water and promotes conservation, reducing leakage and reuse. So both of these sections have been heavily edited. Our county hydrogeologist gave lots of input on this. So open to your input if you have any. I did want to point out there's a typo on the slide. The climate element does cover groundwater as well, but it's under the fourth goal statement, not the third.
Okay. And so public health is ready to drive the creation of the policies and so on to put these things into place. Okay. And Sean's nodding his head yes. Good.
This water section was also where you did reference soil quality issues to my earlier question.
There are some places where things it's going to be have to be a coordination between public health and public works, as an example. So we have goal 4 under climate. We talk about water resources, soil source, aquifer, stormwater management. Stormwater management ends up being a public works activity. Encouraging on-site gray water reuse, that's a big deal, and that's a public health issue. So we really need to the going forward really encourage the partnership between our departments and ensuring that these things are accomplished.
Back in December, we discussed the implementation plan, and in that implementation plan, we will be outlining what topics we'll be discussing
Okay,
or
terrific.
meeting these interdepartmental coordination.
Great. You know,
So
one
I
of our
know, go
Janet.
ahead. So I know that we're going to get some public input on strengthening stormwater requirements because somebody's approached me about that. And that the value exists in our stormwater goal. Ensure water will be preserved for current and future, treating as it is precious, and incentivizing conservation, reducing leakage, reclamation, and reuse. I want to add a cent a value in there. Ensuring water quantity and quality will be preserved, because we not only need enough water, we need quality water. So to worry about stormwater pollutants or the nitrates or other things, I think having water quantity and quality, if it's agreeable to my colleagues, called out as a value, so that when we look at future implementation code or regulations, we have the parameters of not just quantity, but quality in front of us.
Yeah, sounds good. All right.
That makes sense. I just wanted to share too that when the since the board in December asked for an implementation plan, that's on my team's list to draft as part of the kind of final adoption. So we'll have an implementation plan as part of the comp plan, so folks can kind of follow along and see how we're going to work, how the departments are going to work together on implementation steps over the next, 2, 3 years, 5 years, and 10 years. And we are planning to have a all department meeting after this comment period ends, so probably in the February time period to get all the departments' input on that
Terrific.
implementation plan. So we'll make sure we're well coordinated.
And then we need to remind the public that recessions
Okay.
and pandemics and everything can implement the best laid plans.
Yes, that's fair.
Yeah.
Emily, I think you were
Okay.
going to handle this first one. Go ahead.
Yeah. The first section here is about resiliency and all of these lead back to our new climate element. And part of this climate element, I mean, all four of these bullets cover it, but it's to enhance community resiliency to these events. It's to make sure we're prepared well in advance and not scrambling to react. You want to prepare instead of react throughout all of these goals.
So I want to talk a little bit about goal 5 and maybe a little bit about goal 10, but goal 5, this for me is design and improve the local transportation system, including infrastructure routes and travel modes, so that it can withstand and recover quickly from the impacts of extreme weather events and other hazards exacerbated by climate change. This is a public works. That's why I asked public works to be paying attention to this conversation. And more than that, I think that this, I would really like the IRTPO to have a
Yes, thank you,
meeting
ma'am.
that is about goal 5. Because I think that it's not just Island County transportation that needs to be paying attention to this. It's the transportation systems in all of the jurisdictions. And so I think that that would be valuable. And what I was wondering, this is a conversation I need to have with them. I don't know what the agenda is for the month of January for the IRTPO. But if they don't have anything planned for that agenda, this would be useful simply because we're still in the comment period. I would prefer that the conversation happen before the comment period is over with, because the citizens, the excuse me, the jurisdictions would maybe be able would be encouraged to make comments that would perhaps impact ultimately the document.
I think Matthew's online or
Oh,
Fred.
Fred and
Yeah.
Heather are.
Okay.
Fred and
James
James.
and Matt.
Okay, good. I'm
Okay.
glad that they are. So, you guys can get back to me, Ed and Fred and James, about the IRTPO meeting in January and so on. But that's th this section is the reason that I asked that you be listening to today's meeting. And then the other one I mentioned was goal 10, and that's another huge public health one, protecting community health and well-being from the impacts of climate exacerbated hazards. Public health and also human services, but you said that you guys are going to have this implementation
Yes, we
plan, and
are.
so they'll be all over that. So that
No,
sounds good.
I
Thank
just
you.
go through my bullet. I have some points that are not on the slide just to go through really quick. So, like Commissioner Bacon just brought up, the first grouping of policies in Goal 5 is to ensure transportation infrastructure can withstand climate-related events, and this is important in case people have to retreat from climate-related events. We want to make sure our transportation system is able to help with that. The second bullet is to support emergency preparedness and response to extreme weather, and that is related to goal 7. And these policies align the comprehensive plan with the hazard mitigation plan, which is currently being worked on, and also enhances the community re resilience to these hazard events and extreme weather. Goal 9 has policies to reduce and treat stormwater runoff and pollution, policies to enhance fire resiliency in new and redeveloped sites, and policies to encourage building designs to maintain safer temperatures if power goes out. So that is both in high and low temperatures situations, as we just experienced in December. And lastly, goal 10 is related to protecting our most vulnerable populations from climate-related impacts. And these really focus on promoting and providing information and services to support our citizens with upgrading their homes and helping build a more resilient lifestyle, and also considering impacts when we are making zoning changes and updating our plans. So the environmental justice and all of that ties into this. Commissioner St. Clair, did you have anything on those four bullets?
Am I on mute?
No, you're not.
Okay. I was just scrolling through my notes to see if there's anything that needs to be called out publicly. And I mean, I made notes throughout here, but I don't think anything germane to where you are right now in this. It looks good.
Sounds great. Thank you. And thank you for your comments. Okay, back to Emily Neff.
Okay, so for the ag section here, just wanted to call out that the change to Natural Resources Policy 11.16 is to comply with state law. So the WAC clearly says that a countywide analysis is needed to de-designate any ag lands, and we were previously allowing a comp plan amendment for an individual to request de-designation. So that's just a change to make sure we're complying.
Can I ask a question about what that means, Emily, and in practical purposes? And it has to do with sort of, again, how we balance the some of the other values, because we have valuing property rights, et cetera. In that particular requirement that the state made to ensure farmland is not converted, so I'm just playing it out in my head. So I own 140 acres on North Camino, and I am going to conserve 40 acres, but I've decided to allow the remaining 100 acres to be sold. If it is in an area that is in this future value considered to be to do that would be a violation of those state requirements to protect ag lands. Does that restrict the future land use opportunities to that homeowner or a future homeowner who buys that 100 acres? It's just an example.
So this is specific to, lands that are in our commercial ag and rural ag
Yeah,
programs and are designated that
that's what I'm
way.
talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. So anybody who would want to rezone those out of rural ag or commercial ag and into just like a rural property where they could develop it for housing, they
Yeah.
would have to go through basically a periodic update process. So it needs to be a countywide analysis. We can't just look at it as a one-off request to de-designate specific land anymore. And that's kind of what we were allowing on a comp plan amendment basis, because we do those annually. So they could have submitted an annual request to look at their property alone. But what this WAC is saying is we should be looking at whether we have sufficient ag lands countywide before we de-designate anything. So we should really be doing that as part of our periodic update process. So it would require them to go through that instead of
So
doing an annual review, if that helps. So they still have an opportunity to do it, but it has to be part of the bigger picture.
and will take longer.
Yes.
And but it goes to, on one hand, keeping our rural community, big value called out specifically in this plan. It goes to local food security. It goes, that's the reason, that's the why on this side. But it
Yes.
does mean any conversion and opportunities to convert are limited in terms of how often or how it can come forward. and will be under more stringent review.
Yeah, and just to be clear, the county could initiate, a comp plan amendment and do a countywide analysis of ag lands if we got a bunch of these requests or something, if we wanted to do that. So they wouldn't necessarily have to wait the 10 years for the periodic update if there was some reason behind wanting to do that. It's just to try to disincentivize the one-off requests, right? And to think about it more big picture, so we're not de-designating lands that we might need later for food security reasons.
And we have two types of tax benefit lands, ag land and DFL. This does not apply to to forest lands, DFL. It only applies to the ag lands.
That's an interesting question. Let me look at the WAC and see if it's just about ag lands or if it's also, it might be all resource lands, honestly. It might be forest and ag. So I'll make sure that this is worded correctly to cover that, but good call out.
Would you, because it was on my list of things to research, which clearly I haven't done all my homework, but if the state is saying we want to value ag land and you've got counties that have different land trusts that are specific to ag lands, but if the logic flow to me would have been, well, and also because we're such a community of small community-owned forest versus big state forest or federal forest lands, I had that question. So thank you for re researching that for me.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, and then the other policies here, there are two new ones to support ag lands, to kind of protect them from development pressures. There are certainly more policies throughout this section in the land use section for that, but these two are new. And then there's a goal 8 under the climate element is in support of the agricultural economy, supporting resilience. Any questions about any of those new policies? No?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and then finally, under forests, we have made some updates throughout, of course, but there are two new policies to support sustainable forest management under natural resources, 11.7 and 11.8. And then the climate goal 11 and all of its sub policies are also in support of sustainable forest management practices. Anything jump out in those sections? Anybody wanted to call out?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
And I don't know if I, let me check my notes to see if I said this. So I'm in 11.7. Okay, I thought it was done well. I don't know that this is a state or a county policy. 11.7 and 11.8, innovative and sustainable forest management that enhances forest health, protects tree. This is where I wanted to make sure protects tree canopy, especially in urban areas. That's where I had that thought. And 11.8, and I'm sorry, this has to do with Thanksgiving dinner at my house, where my brother is a climate scientist and a forestry expert. Reforestation in and of itself today is not sufficient to actually address the challenges we're facing. They really need, and I don't know, again, if I am so far out of my lane, Emily, just put me back in my box. But really what we need are reforestation practices that recognizes the importance of biodiversity in these uncertain times of climate change, and not just the cheapest, easiest stock you can do for replanting to meet the bare minimum of the requirements. This may be a state policy. And I know that Hillary was approached with some science about this. But both biodiversity and requiring native species may or may not be the right answer, because natives, based on tree migration and climate change, native species may not be what we need to be replanting because they may not be able to be sustainable in higher temperatures. So I'm just, you can tell I don't have an articulate thing here, except that I would maybe add some language that encourages scientifically driven reforestation, or something that allows that our science is telling us things today about biodiversity and resiliency that says native trees are important, but we may not be able to sustain our forests with just native trees and may need to look at what is actually thriving in these higher climates. Did I make any sense there? My apologies.
Yes, I think so. Just the emphasis on native alone is probably not sufficient for where we're at. So I think that makes sense. We can look at that language and see if maybe some more words there would help.
I was really struggling with it, and I was also struggling whether it's even our lane.
If I could add, the goal 11 in the climate element specifically says protect and enhance the climate resilience of forests by implementing climate smart forest management. So
There you go.
we could always further sorry, the word's slipping my mind, further write about it in that element or just
I
fix
got
it.
to plug in my computer. I'll be right back.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Emily, you're right. If we copy over some of that language, so it's not just native plants, but climate smart plants as well, I think
Exactly.
that might cover it.
Sounds good.
Okay. I think we've made it through the policy changes. So kind of big picture, what we were hoping to get from these conversations at the board, and we'll talk with the Planning Commission tonight, is just to confirm that these elements are reflecting the board's priorities in terms of health equity and climate resilience. Confirm that, again, as we discussed in the beginning, that the balance is right between our needs for housing, land use, and natural resources and climate, and is meeting the needs of our residents, all of them kind of working together collaboratively. And then finally, confirming whether the commitments in our climate element feel achievable in the next 10 to 20 years. So we heard a very clear sentiment when we brought this to the board previously that this is our first step into climate resilience planning, and we want to make sure it's attainable and not too far out that we won't be able to achieve these goals in the planning period. So just wanted to make sure that you reviewed with that lens and that you feel comfortable with what we've committed to.
Janet's shaking her head, yes. I think that these elements do reflect our three priorities. I think that there's a balance that you mentioned. Whether or not these commitments feel achievable really is going to depend on the whoever sits in our seats in the upcoming years and whether they make including these statements and these plans and these commitments in the work plans coming up over the coming years a priority or not. I think that if we remain as a community and as a county committed to achieving these goals, they are all of them achievable. But it really will require that the commissioners who come after us and the people who sit in your seats as well, if you move on to other things in your lives, that they remain really engaged and this remains important to them.
I was struck by that, Melanie, when we were looking at water quality and knowing that the current administration is looking at the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. And I believe Emily and our element referenced that overarching federal legislation and this and what drives it. And I think we've always had a standard in Island County to fully achieve what is mandated by the state and federal level, but I worry if sometime in the future we have to exceed their requirements if they're denigrated. I don't know if that's the right thing to say, and I'm trying to avoid politics today.
Yeah. So you made reference earlier, an earlier slide to the critical area ordinance. So can you speak to that and what we're planning to do with regard to that? Because I don't see that in next steps. You say revisions to development regulations, comp plan adoption, critical areas ordinance. Where does that fit into this entire thing?
Yeah, good question. So our critical areas ordinance is a development regulation. It's part of our Island County code. And so it will be the critical areas ordinance. We get 12 months to update after our comp plan is adopted. So whenever our comp plan is adopted and we there'll be some implementation to make sure all the housing related code changes get into the code system. But once we complete that, we'll shift gears, and our first item of business under development regulations will be critical areas. So we'll be kicking off that process after the comp plan's adopted.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. And then
I,
just some, oh, go
I
ahead.
just want to compliment you on, I mean, on both of these elements, but and I know you really worked hard on the natural resources one to make. There's so many changes, and they're great changes. But the climate element is a brand new element, and I think that it's really well done. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Thank you, and
Thanks.
just and thank you to the citizens that participated in our policy advisory team. We met monthly for 4 or 5 months. It was great.
Thank you, citizens. This whole document, it really is heavy dependent upon citizen input, and we're just so grateful to the citizens of Island County. It's been difficult. It takes longer when you bring in all the possible people impacted in the thing, but it really, I think, is going to be very valuable that we did that. Okay.
That's a good segue. So, our comment period is still open and will be until February 9th on all the draft materials. Folks can comment on our website. They can email us. They can send us mail, or they can come in person to meetings. And our meetings are starting this week. So, just wanted to put a plug in for tomorrow. Our first public meeting kicks off in Oak Harbor at the center at 5 o'clock, and we have a presentation that will start at 5:30, and we'll do a live Q&A. So folks who want to ask questions of staff can come to those and ask questions in person. We're going to have one on South Whidbey next week and then Camino next weekend. And then our board sessions will continue. So next week we have the infrastructure session planned for to address capital facilities, transportation, and parks. And then our final session will be on February 4th on economic development and our Clinton subarea plan.
So I plan to attend the one tomorrow night in Oak Harbor, and also the one in South Whidbey. And Commissioner St. Clair, you're going to be on the Camino one on the 24th. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
Okay.
I may try to attend the one on South Whidbey if that's not a just because like you, it's good to be in multiple places, hear multiple voices. But I don't know if that's a requires notice, and I'll let staff advise me as to whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah.
We just need to know, Commissioner St. Clair. It's not an issue.
Okay. So I'm on Whidbey anyway on Tuesdays. I may join you, Melanie.
Okay, that'd be great.
Okay, that's all we had for you today.
Well, goodness. Thank you, all of you. Jonathan, Matthew, did either of you have any things you want to add to the conversation today? You were kind enough to sit up here.
We're here ready for any questions, so we're just here to help.
Okay.
I'll add, I think they did a great job.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Janet, do you have anything else for today's meeting?
I do not. I appreciate your flexibility, and this is really exciting to see this coming together, I think. Jonathan, your team is everybody's teams. Everybody's been involved in this. Just really good work.
It really is. It really is. All right. Thank you. This meeting is adjourned. Oh, I do need to make the statement again that the county offices will be closed next Monday for Martin Luther King's birthday. We're adjourned. Thank you.